My name is Stephanie Ryan. I work at HP Labs, and I'll be talking about Linux IS64. David Mossberger, who is working with me, is also present, so both of us can answer questions if you have that. So I'm here to talk about the Linux IS64 project, and we'll go. Oops. Oh yeah. I have quite some slides to show you, so I'll try to be as fast as possible. So first of all, before talking about the Linux port in particular, we need to do a brief overview of what IS64 is, and because it's, even though it's been made public, I don't know how many of you are very familiar with the architecture. So I'll go over some of the key features that are required in order to understand the kernel part. And the second section, I'll talk about the project, who is involved, what was involved, and then I'll dive directly into the kernel design. And in this talk, I'll focus only on the kernel design. We've made previous presentations where we focus more maybe on the user level and stuff like that, but now it's the first time that we can really talk about the kernel design, because all the specifications have been released so that we can actually give you this presentation. And in the last section, I want to describe to you the development kit that we put out in June that allows people with no hardware to actually start developing and porting applications to Linux IS64 on their Linux PC today. And I brought an IS64 prototype with me, so we have real hardware here, and I try to conclude with a demo. So what is IS64? Well, it's been going on for quite a while now. It's been co-designed by HP and Intel, and the core of the design came from HP Labs back in the early 90s. It's based on a new paradigm, which is called EPIC, for explicitly parallel instruction computing. And I will see in the next slide what it means. And the first implementation of this architecture is the famous Itanium chip, with what was called Merced last year. So it's the Itanium chip. As of today, most of the specifications of this architecture, including the microarchitecture for the Itanium processor, have been released to the public, and they can be downloaded from the Intel website, the developer website. And general availability for the equipment is scheduled to be in the second half of this year, and most likely now first quarter of 2001. So that's where you'll be able to buy a machine like this one. So I told you about EPIC. So what is EPIC? Instruction is explicit parallelism, where again the idea is you expose parallelism right at the core of the instruction, so that the compiler knows that you can execute instructions in parallel. That's by opposition to trying to figure out the parallelism in the CPU. So this time, the job of optimizing and parallelizing the code is up to the compiler. So instructions, just like for the CRUSO chip, are grouped into bundles of 128 bits. And each bundle contains three instructions, plus a field called the template field. The template field is used to encode what type of execution units are needed by the three instructions. For instance, get M for memory, I for integer, B for branch, and F for floating point unit. That's encoded in this part. The other thing that's encoded in this part is the sequential dependencies between the instruction in this bundle and the instruction in the next one, so that if you have like a producer-consumer or register dependency type thing, you can actually say that there is such a dependency and put a, what is called a stop bit, meaning that you need to stop and wait for the complete execution of this bundle before, or even the instruction before going to the next bundle. So when I heard the CRUSO presentation, I said, oh yeah, that's different from this one, meaning that here, if you go to the next generation CPU, like the McKinley chip, you won't need to recompile, because of those, you don't have those timing dependencies that they can have. So that's a difference again, versus pure VLIW that's in this EPIC architecture. We have also a massive amount of resources. So we have 128 general registers, which are 64 bits. We have 128 floating point registers, which are 82 bits each. And they are divided into two partitions. That's important for the kernel thing. And we have also lots of execution units. Here I put the spec for the Itanium. Itanium can execute up to 2 bundles in 1 cycle. So I'm just listing here the key features of IS64. I won't go into details because it would take too long, but I'm just going to show you an example of predication because it's a really nice feature. And if you go back to our other presentations that we gave, we have examples for speculation and loop and rolling. A new point that I have here is the performance monitoring features. This architecture has a very rich set of performance monitoring counters that can be used to profile code and to figure out what the bottlenecks are, what a TLB miss is, and all that stuff. It's very nice. And the other thing, too, is that it has the ability to execute IS32 binaries with no modifications. And I'll talk about that also. In terms of registers, you have also another set of registers which are called branch registers, which are used to hold the target of a branch. We have a set of application registers, which are used to hold state about the stack engine, the loops, the atomic operations. One of them is used for the interval timer. And we have another interesting set, which is the kernel registers, which are 8 registers that are read-write at the kernel level, but only read-only at the user level, so they can be used to hold some kernel state, too, in a safe manner. Another important register is the processor status registers, which contain the current configuration of the CPU, like do I have translation turned on, off, and all that stuff. Another set of registers is the control registers, which are used to change the behavior of the CPU, but also point to system-wide table, like the interrupt table. And they also hold the state of the CPU when you get an interrupt. And also, as I mentioned, we get a set of PMC, PMD registers for performance monitoring, and as well as the classical debug registers for instruction and data. So I mentioned predication. So here I want to show predication combined with another nice feature, which is parallel comparisons. Here on the right, you have a C statement that if R2 equals 0 and R1 equals 1, then you do that. Otherwise, you do this. Okay. So, and here is how it would translate into IS64. And the key, I'm going to go to run through this. And then, so basically, we want to do we first do the test. The two components of the test here are combined into those two statements, which are, as you can see, there is no stop bit here between those two instructions. They're executed in parallel. And basically what you end up doing here is first you take the hypothesis that the test is true. Meaning if P1 is true, as you can see, we execute this statement. So the if branch. If P1 is false but P2 is true, then we execute the second one. So we start off by just saying, oh, let's take the hypothesis that the test is true. And then we run the two comparisons in parallel. And this special version of the compare says, only if the test is false, I'm going to say P1 is false, P2 true. So they can actually be run in parallel in a safe manner. And in the end, if P1 gets true, then you execute the first statement. Otherwise, the second one. And the important thing to notice here is that this if-then-else is executed with no branches. There is absolutely no branches. And if you count, you can execute this in exactly 3 cycles. So, I did something wrong here. So that's an example of predication combined with parallel compare. Another nice feature that is present is the what is called the register stack engine, which basically is some kind of a renaming scheme which allows you on function call to get available registers at no cost, and you avoid spilling and filling registers from memory to get free registers. And basically in this example, I show you, you're in this function A at the top, and this function has basically input arguments, local variables that it holds in registers, and then output arguments that are used to call other functions, call down. And basically, here I show how you would call from function A to function B having 5 parameters. Okay? So what happens is that, as you can see in function A, the first argument of function A is R32. That's the logical name that the program is using. And basically, you put your argument in R47 to R52. Now, when you call the branch to go to the function B, there is a renaming that happens. And R47 now becomes R32. And when you enter function B, R32 is just the first input argument for function B. And again, here I show function B having locals, which the alloc instruction just resizes the frame to accommodate those extra local registers. And when you come back, when you branch back, this cuts back and you get your state back. Now, the registers that were local to function A are not lost. They're still in the physical register file. And they're in this now dirty partition. And what happened is that the stack engine in the background is spilling registers to the memory. And the memory area is designated by the OS and can be anywhere in your address space. And the stack engine is going to spill registers to the backing store when it runs out of physical registers. When you extend, and you reach the end, which is register something like 96, then it needs to get new registers back. And that, at that point, you can spill to memory. And of course, when you come back, they are filled back from memory automatically. So that's kind of like a windowing scheme, but this one is fully dynamic. You can adjust the size as you want. Virtual memory. IS64 has a 64-bit flat address space decomposed in 8 regions of 2 to the 61 byte each, giving you a total of 16,000 petabytes worth of address space at any time. The TLB support page sizes from 4K up to 256 megabytes. And the TLB is composed of 2 parts. There is the translation cache, and then you can also pin entries for things like the kernel or some heavily used pieces of code or data. And for that, you use translation registers. And you have at least 8 data translation registers and 8 instruction data, instruction translation registers. And here I put the specs for the Itanium, where you get 48 for the data and 8 for the instruction. Another new feature of IS64 is that there is a hardware worker for the TLB. It's optional. You can turn it off. And it's called the Virtual Hash Page Table because the lookups are done in virtual mode in the address space. So if you're missing the TLB and the VHPT is turned on, you extend the lookups in memory. The VHPT can be set in 2 different modes. One is called the long mode, in which it's just like a hash table, a global hash table for the entire address space. And the other mode is called the short mode, where this time you get one page per region. You get one table per region. And basically the idea is that you bring in, this table is composed of the level 3 pages of the forward mapping that you have in your OS. And I'll describe that in a moment. So graphically speaking, the regions look like this. So the top 3 bits of the virtual address are used to index which region we are in. So you have 8 regions. You index which region register, and then in this region register, one of the fields is called the region identification, and it identifies one of the 2 to the 24th region that it points to. So that's why at any time you can have up to 8 regions. The rest of the address is used to as an offset in that region. So TLB lookups, same thing here. You just index the region register. So interruptions. So there is the centerpiece of the interruption is this interrupt vector table which the OS has to define. And one interesting aspect of this table is that it actually contains code and not just indirections. And depending on which entry, you can have from 16 up to 64 bundles per entry, and you have one entry per type of interruption. And the idea here is that you can do inline processing of interruption without having to branch out to some code. A nice feature is banked registers. Usually when you get to this interrupt vector table, you need to save some state or do something very quickly, and you need registers for that. What is present here is that on interrupt, the CPU automatically switches from one bank to another and gives you 16 fresh register or free register that you can use right away to save some state or even completely process the interrupt. And of course later, if you need further processing, you can switch back to the normal bank. On external interrupts, the CPU supports up to 256 interrupts, and the priority are based on a class scheme where you have 16 classes of 16 interrupts each. I want to mention this particular one, just like PA-RISC, IS64 has what is called an interval timer counter, and basically it gives you a very cheap way of getting timer interrupts. And basically, you have the timer counter and the matching, and when the two are equal, just like on PA, you get an interrupt in that table. So you can also specify on which of the 256 interrupts you want the timer to show up. IF32 emulation. I know people are interested in that thing. IS64 is not yet another generation of IF32. It's completely different. However, it's able to execute native x86 code with no modification. And for that, it's not software emulation. It's hardware emulation done by the CPU. or it's hardware-assisted emulation. So you can run unmodified application, but I haven't tried that because I don't see the point. But basically, you can also run your x86 OS from scratch. I don't know why you would do that. The idea, of course, is to allow for progressive transitions of application from IS32 to IS64 and do it smoothly. So in the Linux world, it's not that critical because we have source code for so many of the programs that we can just recompile. And hopefully, if they're clean, 64-bit clean and everything, that you're done. But even in the Linux world, you still get some binary-only applications. Then the more famous one is the Netscape browser or your Acrobat Reader or StarOffice or those kind of applications, which you want, but they're not going to be ported to IS64 tomorrow. So you need this transition, and that's what this support is all about. So how do you switch from IS32 to IS64? Well, you have two ways. basically, no matter what, you need to set up the register context for IF32. So some of the IF32 state is hosted into IS64 registers. And then you just, in the PSR register, there is a bit that says, I am in IS64 mode or I am in IF32 mode. So you toggle that bit and then you return from interrupt, and when you're back to user mode, you win, you're in IF32 mode and you can run your Netscape or something. Another way is each instruction set has a special instruction to switch back and forth between the two modes. So that concludes the brief IS64 overview. You have much more on the web, and especially all the specs from Intel and tutorials and everything. So let me just talk about the project. So having said what IS64 is all about, so the question is, what do we want to do? And basically, we wanted Linux to be present the day the first machines shipped to the public. And we want it to be as easy to use as the Red Hat on your PC or the Turbo Linux. You just put the CD-ROM in it, and it installs, and it's usable. So that was the goal. As you can see today, developing IS64 optimized code and the complete suite is kind of a long job, and that's why we started early. Why at HP? Well, as I said, HP is a co-designer of the architecture, so we have in-house expertise and interest in Linux, so that's how this whole thing got started. And from the beginning, the goal was to open source the entire port. As I said, we started the port back in 98. So what was involved at that time, basically, to get the Linux ported to IS64, it's not just a matter of the kernel. You need the other piece of software, and most of the time, this upper part is much bigger than this part. We also needed, what's so interesting about this one, is that at the time we started, there was no IS64 CPU. There was just simulators, and that's what we used. So who was involved? So I said that HP Labs started the project in 98, and then it grew beyond just HP Labs to include CERN in Geneva, who started working on the glibc port. And then later, in the spring of 99, we just co-founded what was called at that time the Trillion Project, which I'm going to talk about in the next slide. The point to notice is that this project has now been renamed IS64 Linux Project. So don't be confused. What was the goal, of course, was to have a single port, not have the, let's say, the Intel port, the VA port, the SGI port, just one, and concentrate all the effort into getting what the best possible port. So, and we wanted to be there at product launch. So who are the partners involved in this thing? Mainly all the major Linux distributors, like Caldera, Red Hat, Turbo Linux, and SUSE, are part of this effort. And Intel, HP, Cygnus, now Red Hat, and SGI, and VA were the founding, and then other companies just joined as we went along. So what are the milestones of this project so far? Well, in February of this year, we released the entire source code for the kernel, the development tools, and the user libraries, and not mentioned here also a bootloader. So everything is already available, and basically we got this out before the machine, so Linux was actually the first OS available on this architecture, and it's readily available. You can go to www.kernel.org and just download the latest patches. You go to, I think it's Sourceware, where you get the latest compiler toolchain and everything. But we're not done, so we're still working on it. So with all that said, I'm going to move on to the kernel specifically, and I'm just going to focus on some of the key subsystems of the kernel. So, just like any other 64-bit Unix system, Linux IS 64 is using the LP64 data model. This means that longs and pointers are 64-bit and integers are 32-bit, which gives you this kind of a breakdown on the data types. It's using Little Endian, but the CPU is able to do both. And you can have big Endian processes. It's not that the entire system has to be big Endian or little Endian. You can have user processes running it in big Endian mode. So with little effort, we think it's possible to support big Endian processes. What were the main design goals? From the beginning, we wanted a pure 64-bit kernel and not try to get some legacy Linux IE32 stuff in it. We wanted to, of course, minimize the modifications to the machine-independent part. We were shooting for a straight port first. And basically, what we added was most of it is located under those two new directories, Arch IS64 and Include Asm IS64. And we decided from the get-go to start using the development branch instead of the stable branch. So even though it may seem like a stupid idea because they're changing every week, in the end, it was a win because the integration was immediate. You just get back to Linux and it just puts it into the whatever development kernel at that time was. We don't have to just catch up every time or catch up from 2.2 to 2.3 with you have major changes between the two. So, and wherever possible, we made sure that the APIs were compatible with Linux IE32, meaning for the signal numbers, the ERNO numbers, and some of the IO control numbers. That's important for not so well behaved programs which hard code those values, which can be kind of a hard problem. And wherever possible, we have tried to follow all the standards for this new architecture. So like the calling convention, the DIG, which defines the platform, how the platform should be, EFI, which is the new standard for the firmware, and the ABI defined for this platform. So how does the kernel use those registers? We have so many that we can use them for some fixed purpose. And that's very useful for some heavily used variables, like in the kernel, the current variable, which is used to point to the current task, is very heavily used. So instead of having to go to memory each time to get the value, you just hardcode this into register. So you say, oh, R13, which surprisingly is called the thread pointer in the architecture, is used to point to the task structure at all time. So when you enter the kernel, you want to see, oh, I want to get some field out of the current task, you just use the R13. Other kernel registers are used to point to other important data structures, like the physical address of the page table of the current task. That's physical address. Those two. And this one, too, is important. We have so many floating point registers that it would cost quite a bit to save them at every context switch. So, as I mentioned, in the architecture, you have two partitions. And the idea is that if you could not use the high partition, we wouldn't have to save it. So what we do is we use some lazy scheme to not save the high partition if nobody else is using it. And in the kernel, we restrict the usage of floating points to the strict minimum. It's not that we don't need them. Sometimes they're very useful for some integer operation or some bit operations because they're faster. Like for multiplication and some bit operation like find highest bit set.
Oops.
Huh? Did I miss something? Oh, I see. So, as everybody knows here, Linux uses two stacks. You have the user stack and the kernel stack, and when you enter, you need to switch. So now with this register stack, plus there is a regular memory stack because you need it no matter what. So you have to deal with four stacks total, two user, two kernel. And the software convention dictates that the memory stack grows down while the register stack engine defined by the architecture grows up. So meaning that when we create a new process, we have, for the kernel part, we need to create two stacks. So one way to do that in one allocation is to bundle it with the task structure. That's what we do. So when we allocate the task structure, we also bundle a space for the memory stack and the backing store, and we make them grow toward each other to detect collision. This little bar here is just the alignment to align this thing to a nice boundary. I think it's 16 bytes. The process state, so Linux uses a struct called struct ptregs, which is save each time you enter the kernel, and it contains the scratch state. Another part of the state is contained into the switch stack, which is save when you context switch, so it's the rest, it's the preserved registers. Finally, another piece of the state is called the thread struct. This one is part of the task struct, and it contains the rest, and here, clearly, it contains the floating point partition, for instance, the high floating point partition, and like the kernel stack pointer, for instance. I was talking about the lazy manage state. Basically, the idea is you save only if, suppose you touch the high floating point partition, and then your context switched out. The idea is, oh, we are not going to save this high partition now. We just delay and hope that nobody else is going to touch it. And if so, we don't need to save it. So, but to make sure that you don't lose your state, what we do is we disable access to this partition. That's possible. So basically, every new access is going to trap. And at that point, you say, oh, I know somebody else is trying to access that, so I need to save it and then re-enable it. And that's the mechanism that we use here, that is described here, to just make sure that if we're lucky, we just get back our state without having to save anything. And currently, I think on the SMP code, we're just saving it systematically. And in the future, I think we're going to use another technique based on inter-process, so interrupt. The debug and performance monitoring state is using more or less the same technique. If we don't use it, we don't save it. So now we move on to system calls. Just like I think on x86, we're using a software interrupt instruction to trap into the kernel. This is the break instruction. And basically, what we need to do is we break, we go into this interrupt vector table, we need to switch the stack, and then figure out which system code it is, call it, return, restore stack, and leave the kernel. In the future, we're going to use this enter privilege code instruction, which basically when you put it on the gate page, it can raise your privilege automatically, so you just go to this branch to this gate page, execute this instruction, and all of a sudden you have your priv level good enough to enter the kernel. So I said we need to switch stacks, so we have two stacks, and that's not so difficult. You have to be careful in the order of operations, but basically here in this picture I show you before. So before, basically the state of the stack, of the two stacks, is described by those three registers. R12 is the memory stack pointer, so that one grows down. And the register stack engine backing store is described by those two registers, BSP store, which is the bottom of it, and the BSP, which is the top. And in this partition here, that's where you would spill the dirty physical registers. So when we switch, we're in the kernel, and what happens is that we simply, on system calls, here it's shown on system calls, you just make R12 point to the top of this data structure that we allocated. And the DSP store is pointing to this area just above the task structure. And the BSP is automatically adjusted by the CPU to account for the dirties. So the distance here is preserved automatically, and you're done. And this area is not touched anymore. So that's how the stack switching is done. Another performance critical aspect of the system call is the parameters. You don't want to have to copy the parameters from the user to the kernel. And clearly, you want is to pass them in registers, which is the standard way of doing it on IS64. You can pass up to 8 arguments in registers. So, and that's what we do. So you enter, you do system calls by just leaving the arguments in the stacked register, which are those register R32 and up. Now, the problem with this approach is that some system call can be restarted. And by restarting, you mean you want to get back the original arguments. And if they're passed in registers, the function can then modify them, and you lose them. So the solution that we came up with is to use a special attribute in GCC. Basically, all the system call entry points, those functions with sys underbar something, they have a special attribute that says syscall linkage, which means that if the function ever needs to modify those arguments, it needs to make a copy. And then you're safe because those arguments are just preserved. And if you have to restart, they're just present. Now, on the virtual memory, as I said, you can have multiple page sizes. But the Linux kernel today doesn't support variable page sizes. However, you can, at configuration time, specify which page size do you want. And that's what we do. So when you do make config or make xconfig or whatever, you can specify which page size you want. A problem with that is that all programs need to use the get page size system call in order to retrieve what is the current page size and not just guess, oh, it's 4K or it's 8K, or just use something that's in a header file. But hopefully, most of the programs use this approach. So why bother? Yeah?
Is there a way to call that from userland?
Sorry?
Is there a way to tell that from userland?
Yeah, you call this?
No,
that's a system call.
Okay.
Why multiple page sizes? Well, clearly, if you want to have perfect IF32 emulation, you want 4K because that's what's used for on x86 today. So if you have programs that want, oh, I want an mmap at this specific 4K address, then that's the perfect match. But for IS64 binaries and programs, that's not as good because of the code expansion and all that. So for IS64, you prefer 8 or 16K pages. So that's why we have the flexibility to choose whatever we want. And another aspect is that bigger page sizes yield a bigger virtual address space, as we'll see. So IS64 has 8 regions, and we make use of the 8 regions for specific purposes. I'll start from the top down. So the kernel is at the top, using the top 2 regions. Right. And you have cache and uncache, which are 2 different ways of accessing physical memory. So that's how those 2 regions are identity mapped. So offset 0 in this maps to address 0. And we use a large page size because the page size is determined per region. It's not global. You can adjust it for every region. So here we use a large page size, and for the kernel, which is in region 7, we even pin the text of the kernel with a translation register. Then we go to region 5, which contains the vmalloc allocator, and then that's the user part of the virtual address space, where we put the 2 stacks in region 4, the data, text, shared memory, and then we reserve region 0 for the IF32 emulation. So this gives you 16,000 petabytes. So Linux is using a three-level page table forward mapping, and that's what we use for those top, those bottom five regions from 0 to 4, and that's how the virtual address space is decomposed. Here it's shown with an 8K page size, so that's why you get 13 here, and then 10 for the middle here, and the top part is split between the two. You get the region number, which uses 3 bits, and then the 7 bits for to get 10 to 10, because in an 8K page you can only hold 2 to the 10th pointer. Now with this setup, with 8K pages, you get 2 to the 43 bytes address space. Of course, if you increase 16, you get a much bigger one, and so on and so on. If you look at the paper, I have a table with the mapping between the two. That's for the region 0 to 4. Another thing I didn't mention is that those bits, if I go back, I want to go back. Yeah, that's this one. Is that those bits in red are just sign extension of bit 39. That's software imposed. So you cannot... My laptop is kind of old, huh, as you can tell. It's coming? Oh. There it is. No. Oh. I need to change it. Huh? So when you look at the layout of the region, you get this big hole in the middle created by this sign extension. So you can access here at the top, but not in the middle. Ah. Is it the next one or the previous one? Ah, it's automatic now. So I have to follow it. So region 5 is the vmalloc allocator, and it's also used to put a gate page for signal and has a guard page for security. And basically this one is different because this one has its own page table. So what that allows you is that you can now recycle those 3 bits that you were using for the region. That's why you get 10 bits at the top. So you get a bigger address space. Here you get the full 43-bit address space total. And again, we use the sign extension for the bit 43 to 60, the extension of bit 42. So let's try. Oh. Is it coming? Gee, let's try this one. Ah. Uh-oh. Hey. Did I lose it? Yeah, I lost it, huh? Uh-oh. Yeah, I think I lost it, huh?
You see my cursor somewhere?
Yeah, I...
Try something else.
Try
right-click. Wait a second.
I try something, yeah, it's lucky.
Oh, you it's see? Frozen.
It's frozen, huh? So even escape doesn't work.
Ouch. Time for the demo?
No. Oh, let's see. Let me just do this.
Try to go back. Maybe it's okay now. Oh, you killed it.
Yeah. I want to restart it because I have some other... You see it? No. I need to restart it. Okay. Let's hope we can restart. Coming back.
Good.
Huh? Oh, wow.
That's the projector.
That's the projector this time. Huh? the microphone still working at least? Oh, good. So I don't know what to expect for the demo. Huh? It's no good. Ah. So we were at slide what?
45.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we can go directly to this one. You've seen that, that. Oh, I see. Right click. Let's do it manually. Yeah. So you stop me. We did that, Yeah. Did that. Hey. Oh. Did that one. Getting closer. I think he doesn't like the big pictures. Did that one. Ah, there is a big one coming, yeah. Yeah, did that?
Don't go back.
We were, that's where we were? No. Yeah, no, the next one. Okay. Let's move. Wow. Oof. So I didn't talk about the VHPT, and Linux IS64 uses the VHPT because it's so good for speed up of the TLB insertion. So we use the short mode because for Linux it's very natural. We have this three-level page table, and the VHPT in short mode expects something that has the format more or less of this third level on the picture. So basically what we do is we just take this third page, third level, the last one, and that's the one we use for the VHPT because it has the same format. So we made sure it uses the same format. So that's how it happens. We just map this page into the address space of, into the region's address space, into the user address space per region. And the VHPT just uses it automatically. An interesting property of this is that each time you insert, because the VHPT can fault, of course, it's just searching, there is no page, so that's at the point where you need to install that page. Each time you bring in an 8K page, it covers 8 megabyte worth of translation, of address space, sorry. Now the question is, where do you place this table in the address space? Because basically you don't want the user to be accessing it. Oops. Another aspect of the architecture is that the virtual address space doesn't necessarily have to be 64-bit. That's the dream. The architecture imposes that at least 50-bit of the virtual address space be implemented. So on Itanium, it's 50. That's the first one, so let's try that. And so basically, again, we have a gap, we have a set of bits which are not used. And that's where we would like to we put the table. So now, nice color. So if you look back at this layout of the region, maybe it's too long. So basically, if you look back at this region again, you get you get this red region, which was the 2 to the 39, the software imposed an accessible region, which is what you would read here. And the blue zone is this unimplemented address space, which is imposed by the implementation here. And that's where we put the table. The VHPT is just put above this unimplemented region. So there is no way you can access it. So it's safe. And here on the side, you get the specific offset or addresses. Here it's for, oh, I did something wrong here. It should be zero. That's how we place the table. So it's per region. So from region 0 to 4, that's where we put the table. So now, I don't talk about the signal subsystem. If you look at the paper, I describe in detail more or less the principle that we use to do signal handling using a trampoline instead of generating code on the fly. And I'll skip directly to the IF-42 subsystem because there is no magic. And that's, oh, that's magic. You just take your LS or Netscape and it runs. But you need a little work, bit of work in the kernel for that to happen. And that's what I describe here. Basically, we want to support Linux IF32 binaries as is with no modification. And including, I didn't say specify, including shared binaries, not just the static thing, the pure. So you take your SUSE distribution, bring in something, and it works. So what's needed at the kernel level? Basically, you need two loaders. Two ELF loaders, one for ELF64, which is a format used by the Linux IS64, and you also need an ELF32 loader, which is the one used for x86. Now, because they use different data models, you need to sometime emulate system calls, and I don't like emulate, it's more conversion of some of the parameters of system calls. And the kernel also needs to set up the IF32 context. When you go back to user mode, you expect certain registers, IF32 registers to have certain content, and that's what needs to be done by the kernel. Now, at the user level, you also need to do some operations. Basically, you end up with two dynamic loaders, one for IF32 and one for IS64, and we made sure they wouldn't conflict by just using another naming scheme here, so they're different. And we also had to modify slightly the runtime linker so that when it tries to resolve a library, first it takes into account the architecture type. So if you're looking for libm, you also need, it's not just libm, you want libm for IF32 or libm for IS64, and that needs to be done by the runtime linker. And the search, it says, oh, two parameters, you need to search for libm, and the architecture doesn't work, you continue and just stop. So that's the kind of modification we've had to do. On system calls emulation, basically the processing, the amount of processing you need to do varies depending on the system calls. Some system calls is just straight, like get PID. There is no differences, right? So you just, when you enter the kernel from IF32, you trap into the kernel. At this point, you're back to IS64 mode in this IVT table, and you're executing an entry that is specific to IF32. At that point, you just extract the system call number, look into the IF32 system call table, figure out which system call it is, and if it's no modification, then you just call the sys-get-pid function directly, no modification. If you need to do modification, you need to go through a stub that would do translation. So an example of system call where you need systematic conversion is get time of day or set time of day because the struct time val is different. So no matter what, you need to do it. Some other system calls like IO control or, I don't know, file control, you need to check on the parameters. For some IO control which use certain data structure, you need conversions. For some others, you don't. So here it depends. So here I describe how you do the entry to the kernel. Another aspect that is important is that we place the IF32 binaries in region 0, and region 0 is large enough to hold any IF32 binary and need for a virtual address space. Another important thing that simplifies this whole processing is that we made sure that the IA64 constant were equal to the IF32. Like if you do an IO control, I don't know, on the Ethernet or something, the same value is associated with the same operation. So you don't need to do an extra conversion here. I think I'm now going to stop for the kernel. You have more material in the paper, and we're willing. David and I, we can answer or anything. I see Richard. I see maybe Yes is in the audience. We can answer questions on the kernel. I want to talk about the SDK, which is this thing that apparently was very popular this morning because they're all gone. It's this software development kit which you can use on your PC to develop applications for this system. I think we have more. We're here or on the back of the room. That's it. And you're free to take one per person. So let me explain what it's all about. When we started, as I said, when we started this work, don't go now. Hey, listen to what you pick up, otherwise you won't understand what's going on. Basically, when we started this work, there was no machine, right? So how do you come up with the mini distribution, or how do you recompile the key packages like LS, init, and all those things? Well, yes, you take your 600 RPMs and you go manually through each of them, and each time you need to fix the MEC files because you need to use the cross-compiler, not the pure compiler. Well, I don't want to get into, but how do you do configure the autoconf? Because if you execute this autoconf, generates code, but or compile code, but execute the code. You don't want to execute x86 code. You want to retrieve the IS64 parameters, not the x86 one. So that's it can be done, but not by two persons, right? So what we decided to do instead is to build what we call a native user environment, or an approximation of how it would look on the real machine at the shell prompt, meaning that the goal was to put the development tools, the linker, header files in their natural location. So CC, bin CC, or user bin CC is the cross compiler, LD is the cross linker, and user include systypes.h is the IS64 header file, so that from an RPM package perspective, it's just a normal system. So that was the goal. The way to achieve that is to create a separate tree from your Red Hat or whatever distribution. So on your PC, you have like not a shadow tree, but a copy of a tree that looks like a Red Hat tree. And the magic is that you change root into that environment, and all of a sudden, you're executing IF32 binaries, but with some magic coming in from the HP simulator, you can actually execute those binaries. And the trick is, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the module called bin format MISC. This one allows dynamic binding of binary types to an interpreter, like Java, for instance. You would like to type your Java class, I think, at the shell prompt directly. And the magic, just like a shell script, when you invoke a shell script, the prompt, it just, the kernel just says, oh, it's a shell script, and it does sh on it. Here, this bin format MISC module creates the same thing. And basically, when we find an ELF64, we just say, oops, we need to run the HP simulator on it. And this one has a batch mode, so it's like no messages at all, and you just get this natural execution at your shell prompt. So with all those things in place, something like that becomes possible. You just get your source RPMs and just regenerate them manually or even automatically, and they would pick up the right values because the compiler generates IS64 code, which is then executed using the simulator. Whoops. So that's for user applications. The other thing that this developer kit brings you is the ability to run the kernel on your PC. Basically, the simulator can also execute in what is called system mode, where you have all the VM interrupts and emulation, so you can actually boot the Linux IS64 kernel. And the disk and everything are, I'm just going to show that in the next slide, sorry. The important thing is that the simulator can be used not just for Linux. We use it mostly for it, but there is nothing in it, at least for kernel development, that is specific to Linux. In user mode, that's different because we need to do system call emulations. But for kernel development, it can be used for OSs. And you can get the CD-ROM from us here, but you can also download it for free from the HP Software Depot website. So let me just describe what's going on when you develop, let's say, a user application. You get this entire thing here, the VI and stuff is just a single process. So this key simulator incorporates an IS64 instruction set emulation, clearly. But to run user applications, it also has a layer of system call emulation. Just like we do IS32 to IS64, that one does IS64 to IS32 conversions and back. So that if you generate like main, an IS64 binary, you can just run it and it's going to use the host OS to do open, read, write, etc. And it has a built-in debugger, which can be used to debug user applications, but also kernel. And the entire environment is self-contained, so you just develop using your VI, which can be an x86 or an IS64 binary. You generate, you compile using the standard tools, and you go back. That's for user mode. In kernel mode, as I said, basically, you get the instruction set simulator in system mode, and then you take the Linux IS64 source code, which is available from the website, kernel.org, and you configure it for the HP simulator. And in it, it has three key drivers which are used to simulate the devices, because this simulator doesn't have the whole platform. It has only, it uses an Xterm to simulate the console. So we have a simulated serial driver here, which tracks into the simulator, and you get the output on an Xterm. Similarly, for the SCSI, we have a dummy, or it's not dummy, a simple SCSI driver that translates, that tracks into the simulator, and you just do read and write on a big file that simulates the SDA or SDB, etc. You can even do network access directly from this IS64 Linux kernel, and meaning that you can actually, from a remote machine, ping this thing. It has its own IP address, different from the host IP address. So you can FTP, rlogin, NFS mount from this guy to the world. That's completely possible. And that's what on this CD. No, on this CD-ROM you get the binary only. Not that I know as of today. I have no plan for that. You don't really need that.
Yeah, 640K is enough for everyone, right?
Okay, so what do I have next? Oh, that's the end. That's the end. So the message that I want you to receive is that Linux IS64 is real. It's already available. It's been available for like 6 months now. And we're starting to get real distributions from Red Hat and Turbo Linux. So if you go to their website, you can actually get a CD-ROM, which I have here. You get a bootable CD-ROM that you can use on prototype hardware, but you can also use it, extract the packages, and use those packages inside this environment. The other key point is that we're not done. It's not like we have it. We're still working on it, and we have a big team that is working on it to get it better, improving the performance, working on SMP, getting it better, etc., etc. So I think now I have a bunch of URLs. So the important one is the trillion one. And the SDK, as I said, you can get it from the HP Software Depot. So maybe what I'll do is first show you this demo. I have a demo of this thing. Show how you can use it, if I can return. Yes, I can. Time to leave here. Ooh. Yeah. So let me do that. So on my laptop here, I can develop IS64 Linux applications, and I can also do kernel development. And in fact, that's how it got started. Yeah. So I am here on my Linux. How do I get this? Oh, let me do that. If I can get... Okay. It's really slow. Let me just give... bigger font. Is that better, huh? So I'm on my Linux x86 Pentium 1 233, kind of old, P5. And I have this environment installed. It's just a bunch of, I think, 3 or 4 RPMs that you can install directly on your system. And you just invoke the environment by typing new. And at this point, you just change root to this... copy special tree, and you get a shell prompt. And here, if you type things like uname-a, you see that it reports IS64. If you type arch, oops, that's no good. This one I think I missed, but let me make sure I am here. You see CC is the IS64 CC. I don't know why arch is no good. Huh? And the LD, etc., etc. So, and here I have a small lo.c program, which is hello world, I think. So I can just compile this lo.c-o hello, oops. And hopefully, if I do a file on hello, it tells you that's an IS64 shared binary. So that's already good. Now you can also invoke hello. And that should work. Yeah. First time is good. So that's how you develop applications.
So that's using the bin format disk?
Yes. So, okay. I'm going to show you the magic because people sometimes are confused on the mailing list sometimes. Okay, so if you look at proc, where is it? Sys, FS, bin, FMT, MISC, you see what's going on. Yes, that's the magic. It's here. Oh. The magic says... You can see it here. If you see a binary with this magic number, invoke this interpreter. That's how when I type hello, it says, oh, that's the magic number. Just do BSCII-NC on hello. And that's how you get it. And in fact, if I dare to do it, I think, does that work? That works too. You see, that's what's going on. So that's how you do user level, but you can also do kernel level, as I said. So here's how you can just boot a Linux kernel. So here I just say the simulator on the bootloader, and the bootloader is going to load VM Linux, which is an arc, a binary of the kernel. And I tell it that the simulated SCSI disk is here in this location. So you get the simulator with the register, a dump, and where you are in the code, and etc., etc. And then you just type run. Yes, I had forgotten that one. You need to set up your display variable correctly. Believe me, correctly. Yes, that's the one. There it is. So... there it is. So it's booting, and you see it detected the SCSI disk here. And I don't have the Ethernet turned on, but if you turn on the Ethernet, then you would see that it would detect the local Ethernet and use it, etc. So my laptop is slow, so it would take like 5 minutes or 2 minutes or so to boot to the login prompt. So I'm going to stop now and maybe move to the hardware demo. So I've read recently that there are like, what, 15,000 of those prototypes around here. So we have one. We're lucky. So here it is. It's called the Big Sur prototype, and it's the workstation prototype. It goes up to two-way. And this specific prototype has 1 gig of memory. It has only PCI 64 slots and AGP Pro, I think. And what else? It has a SCSI... Oh, yeah. It has a SCSI controller, a 64-bit PCI Q-Logic controller in it. No ISA. When I say PCI 64, there is no more ISA. Yeah. The other thing that, I don't know how you're going to react, the other thing is that in the end, you're going to lose the PS2 interface. You're going to have only USB. yeah. And it has an IDE CD-ROM and a LS120, so a super floppy. It's not, you don't get the legacy floppy disk anymore. So I think I want to do the boot just to show. So the other thing that's not present anymore is the legacy BIOS from the PC. There is no more PC BIOS. So you won't be able to plug your MS-DOS floppy anymore. I'm sure you would like that one. Huh? Sorry?
Has a ROM monitor or something now, or instead of a BIOS? No,
it has a new form of BIOS called EFI, which is a spec that is available to the public, and it's not just meant for this platform. It can be used on the PC in the long term. I think that's to replace it. So I'm just rebooting it so that you can see how it boots and how you get to this. What is called an EFI shell prompt, because basically the BIOS is smarter than the pure PC BIOS. It gives you a small shell, which looks surprisingly close to a command.com shell. And from then, it's OS neutral. So from this EFI shell, you can boot either HPUX, Windows, that's how you enter the setup. Huh? No good. And or Linux IS64 or whatever. The PAL and SAL are the processor abstraction layer and the system abstraction layer, part of the more or less firmware of the machine. Oops. And as you can see, it's still in debug mode. And here it is. So the firmware searches the buses for devices. And here it shows you that it found a hard disk and then a second hard disk, that as soon as it finds a device that has a bootable partition, and by bootable partition it means a device which has a DOS file system or a VFAT or Windows 95 partition. Or it can also do network boot, etc. But here on the hard disk, it's looking for those partition, and if it finds some partition like that, it just maps them to logical names. So here you see that this device, this partition has been mapped to FS0 or FS1, just like you get C colon or D colon, etc. Here you get FS0 or FS1. I need to be there. So now, at this point, it's like a small shell. You have command and everything. More or less like the command.com. So you have deer. Well, I need to switch to I think I need to go to FS1. You see? Doesn't look similar. You like it, huh? Yeah. Okay. So here I'm in this FS1, which is the second disk, a bootable partition, and you can see the Linux kernel and the bootloader here, or LILO or ELI, we have two bootloaders. And you can just invoke and load the thing. So before doing that, I think I need to do that. Okay. So now I just say LILO vmlinux.se, and I just specify that the root disk is sdb2. Just like you would on the normal LILO on your PC, right? And then it's going to load the kernel. Press. And then it's the usual boot sequence. It detected the USB, UHDI controller, and it's checking the SCSI. And basically, here I'm showing the Turbo Linux Alpha release. That's the one I have on my system. So it's the 5.5 release. You can get it from their website, and I think they came out with a new one just yesterday, which you can download. So I think better GNOME support, and et cetera, et cetera. And here I'm showing 2.4-test1 kernel booting. Here it is. So now, and from then it's just the usual thing, you get free, this time Arch works, huh? Good. I'm not faking it, huh? And I think we can go to graphical mode here, if that works. Yeah, I'm sure you want that one, huh? Here it is. So what do you get? Does it tell you a lot? I think another one is more this one. Where is it? Like that thing you want, huh? And what is the other one? The processor info, what's there? And you have all sorts of information. Where is that? I didn't really need the cache or VM info, et cetera, et cetera. So let's go to graphical mode. I show you that because it's all public information. It's all in the microarchitecture document you can download. So there is no secret here. So here it's just the GDM, I think that's what it's called, the banner. And oops, my mouse. So it's a USB mouse here. Oh, I didn't get the font correct. I don't get the font correct. Yeah, I'm missing the fonts here. I knew something would be wrong. So I'm not getting the right font, so you're not going to see. The color is not good either. But so it's the classical GNOME environment. All IS60, everything I show here is IS64 recompiled. So you get you get Emacs, classic. You get VI, etc. So I want to show you some IF32 emulation because that's always impressive. So I'm going to do Acrobat Reader. What I did for Acrobat Reader, I went to the Adobe website, I downloaded the tar file, installed it on this machine, and it just ran. So where is this? I think it's in user local. Huh? Is it here? I think it's in the reader. Oh, Intel, it's in reader. Intel, oh, I just want to show you. Bin and this one. So if I do a file on this one. This one is an L32. You see? So I can just do acro read and you get it. Oh, I'm going to have some phone problem. Huh? I didn't think about that one. And hopefully it's going to come back unless there is a font. Phone is killing it.
This is reading.
Yes, it is. I got the demo effect, you know, it couldn't. So I'm sorry. Die.
Did you try this before?
Yeah? Oh, it was working yesterday. it was working yesterday. So I guess we can reboot and we can take questions. I'm rebooting. Because this one is completely dead, huh? Yeah. Let's do it this way, the clean way. Unless the projector is living. So if we have questions, I think.
The current prototype, I mean, you're not going to be as fast as the final.
No. You want to answer that one?
That's really easy to answer. We can't answer that.
The other thing, it's a prototype, so how can you measure that stuff? Not everything is turned on full speed. So, yes. All right. So, but it's bad. This one is 500. So any other questions?
How much hardware overhead, how much extra